We kicked off the show on Thursday, July 11th, with a visit from the mayor of Stratford, Laura Hoydick. We moved along and took a look at how Bridgeport, Hartford, and New Haven are run, the amount of efficiency there, with an analyst from WalletHub.com. 4 o'clock hour, we had a visit from State Consumer Protection Commissioner Michelle Siegel on the future of hemp farming in the state. And we wound up on a discussion regarding immigration. A lot of folks with some passionate thoughts.
Listening to Connecticut Today with Paul Pacelli on WICC 600.
Yeah, hi, that's us. Look at that, huh? My door code still works. It's a good day when I can get out of bed, straighten up, look outside, see the sunshine, and when I get here to WICC, my door code works. It's Paul Pacelli. It's Connecticut Today. How are you? Thursday, downhill of the weekend. Not a bad day out there. More heat coming in the next few days. But today, partly cloudy, a little muggy, 82 degrees. My name is Paul Pacelli once again. And on the other side of the glass, the erstwhile producer that I have every day, Aaron Johnson. You'll speak to him when you called in here at 203-333-9422, 203-333-WICC. Before we get into the real heavy stuff of the day, all the burgeoning local and national topics, we want to touch base with a local leader, and we will be doing this from time to time here on Connecticut Today. Local mayors, first selectmen, movers and shakers in the community. So figured we'd start out in Stratford, and joining us right now is Mayor Laura Hoydick. Mayor, good afternoon. How are you?
Good afternoon, Paul. I'm great. How are you?
Great. And listen, I wanted to start with Stratford because my producer, Aaron, is a Stratford resident. I will give you, when we're done, I'll give you his license plate number. So just let, you know, if he's not quite in the right parking space, that'll be okay, right?
Of course.
See that, Aaron? I got that for you. Mayor, how are you? Stratford, how is, I know you may have a little biased look at this, but how is Stratford doing these days?
I think we're doing really well, Paul. I am pleased with all the things that are happening in town, and the council, our town council, which is our fiduciary and legislative body, is maintaining and doing great things. They approved 2 tax decreases in the last 2 years, and we're trying to improve the quality of life, and people seem genuinely happy here.
How is it that you are able to, and I know it can be done despite what the general drumbeat here is in the state, Mayor, how are you able to hold the line and, in fact, lower taxes?
Well, we had the right opportunities come up with our financing and some bonded debt going offline that we didn't have to use for debt service. That was a great help. We negotiated well with our unions and are collaborating and trying to work on the same page and be the team that makes Stratford better. So there are reasonable expectations from our labor perspective. We've had grand list growth and some incentives that we've offered to businesses to be here. And I've heard from the local banking community that our housing stock is increased in value and is really moving well. And so that, accompanied with reasonable interest rates, I think that's all part of the big picture.
You know, you mentioned a couple of seconds ago, Mayor, you talked about bonding, and we hear bonding so often now on a local, municipal level and on a state level. It's a tool, isn't it? But it also has to be used, and you were, of course, in the General Assembly once, so you faced all this year in and year out. It's got to be used responsibly, correct?
It is absolutely correct. And so what our focus has been through our finance director, our chief administrative officer, the council, myself, is, like we did in the General Assembly, keep a lid on bonding. You know, we in the General Assembly, we capped the bonding. And then any extra surplus that we had from revenue gains went into the rainy day fund or went to decrease the teacher's pension plan on purpose so we could actually have a little more flexibility if we needed major infrastructure projects and needed to bond for. And we're doing the same thing in Stratford. You know, we have road repair that we have to take care of and major things. We have a big high school project that is going to be beautiful, but those are big costs. And so in order to keep everything manageable and our debt service at a good level, we can't overextend in a lot of areas. We have to keep it balanced.
Laura Hoydick is the guest, the Republican mayor of the town of Stratford. Laura, you talked a couple of minutes ago about the housing stock, the business community, realtors. That's a real barometer, isn't it? Just a basic barometer of, hey, do people want to live here, A, and B, what are the houses going for?
So it depends on where you live, but if you talk to our residential realtors, there are certain segments of the town that are really in high demand. Mm-hmm. By the water, of course, Paradise Green is very hot, and Orinoke Village is doing beautifully right now. And we have realtor breakfasts, our realtor meetings, with our commercial realtors and our residential realtors to get, you know, to keep our finger on the pulse of what's happening and make sure that we're moving in the directions that that is best for the community. And I am really pleased that Stratford is selling well.
Well, that's great because, you know, you and I reread the same papers, same stuff online you dealt with in the General Assembly, the drumbeat of people moving out. But you're seeing an influx in the town?
We are seeing an influx, and we will know for sure after the census is completed.
Mm-hmm. Areas of the town that are under the eye of major projects. Now, you mentioned the high school, I know that, but what else is the tax money being used for in the town that maybe a lot of folks, maybe your residents, surrounding areas, might not be in connection with?
So we've got some major infrastructure projects, highway projects, mm-hmm. Route 110, the exit off 52 the Mayor Parkway. We just did the groundbreaking with Sikorsky Aircraft Monday, and that's going to alleviate traffic congestion.
Which has been that's been a bottleneck for as long as I can remember.
Exactly, and we actually passed an ordinance the council did about blocking that box there, cars coming under the lights and blocking oncoming traffic that it's just became such a bottleneck, it was so difficult to manage. So that project has started. Sikorsky is investing $1.6 million. The state of Connecticut is investing $1.5 million to realign the lights of Sikorsky's exit and Orinoke Lane so the traffic flow will remove actually one light and then the traffic flow will flow better. Exit 32 on Interstate 95 southbound is getting a whole new redo on the exit ramp, and so some of our local dollars for Linden Street and West Broad Street will have improvements there. And then an exciting thing for us in our commercial district bound by the dock and right before you go over the Devon Bridge or the bridge into Devon, mm-hmm. Exit 33 will have a full interchange, and that is actually out to bid. So those are state projects that are going to incentivize and enhance our local projects here.
You know, Mayor, you mentioned just two or three highway exits. There are a lot of people don't realize, and I've seen these done in my hometown and other towns, people don't realize, do they, that these, you just can't throw together a remodeled exit ramp, an on-ramp or an off-ramp in a couple of weeks. It's a major project to do this.
You are absolutely right. They're major, they're long. And Exit 33, John Harkin started working on that when he was the state rep for the 120th District. So it's probably about 20 years for that project to happen.
Hey, we don't want to rush things in the state. You know, we want to make sure we have it right, right?
That's right. But we have some other projects that we're working
sure.
on. So through the EPA, we have some Raymark waste that they are remediating and moving out of town. Some is going to be encapsulated and some is moving out. And that's an ongoing project. We have the Center School development, which is going out for RFQ for developers. And that's in the transit-oriented district. And we're very excited about allowing people to live there and be able to walk to the train station and not have to get into a car and get onto the gridlock of 95 or 8 or the Mayor Parkway. So these are some exciting things that we have and happening around town. 2 years ago when I was serving, because the numbers were balanced between Republicans and Democrats, I thought we were a very effective General Assembly doing things that the state wanted and needed it for its residents because we had that balance and people were collegial and they worked very closely together. I am now, as a member of Connecticut Conference of Municipalities, which is abbreviated to CCM, working very closely with mayors and first electmen to ensure that the General Assembly understands the perspective of the municipalities so they know what strategies or what policies that they want to implement and how it's going to affect all of our taxpayers in our school districts.
And you're in a unique position because there aren't I know it happens every so often, you know, a mayor or a first electman goes to become a member of the General Assembly and vice versa, but I don't think it happens enough. You know what I mean?
I have to agree with you, and it's very funny. The ones that have done it usually serve on our committees that interact closely with the municipalities because they have that experience and that perspective, and they can advise those of us that didn't at the time how this is really going to be portrayed at home, what these policies might do.
You mentioned earlier in the general state of the city you gave me that you had a good relationship and got a good working relationship and good feedback and concessions from your municipal unions. That is so important. We all know that municipal unions are hardworking people, the vast, vast majority of them. You know, they do take a little flack here and there sometimes for the benefits and the pay, but they also have to come to the table, and I'm hearing that from you. I also heard that when I worked in Hartford from Mayor Luke Bronin up there, who was able to, you know, carve out these give and take agreements to help stabilize the fiscal picture of Hartford.
Well, we're not doing this in a vacuum, right? We have to work together. Well, let me just say, if we don't work together, the mm-hmm. outcomes are usually not as beneficial to all. So, you know, when everybody gives a little bit, the outcomes are usually better. And mm-hmm. I'm really fortunate with our unions on the town side, and then. Prior to being a state representative, I was on the Board of Education in Stratford and have worked very effectively with the education union. So I think that the communication that we have and the understanding is a benefit to all of us.
The last census, of course, was 2010. We have another one coming up next year. The numbers will shake out about 9 months to a year after that. Stratford's last population, roughly, give or take, about 52,000. It's not the small town it used to be. I remember growing up 30, 40 years ago. Oh, Stratford, yeah. People leave Bridgeport and they go to Stratford. You're getting to be a pretty good-sized municipality. And do you anticipate any bigger growth coming out of the census?
I do anticipate bigger growth because we are also, in our transit-oriented district, we have more housing projects. We just opened up one at 335 Ferry Boulevard, that's 73 units. We had 111 Stratford Avenue, I think that's 150 units. There's another one down Ferry Boulevard, that's another 20 units. So there are housing, because people are utilizing mass transit to get to and from work, there are housing projects that are going to increase the number of people that live here, mm-hmm. our population. So I do anticipate that we will grow a little bit, but one of the best things about Stratford is not only the hometown feel, it's also our diversity. We have people from all over the world, and it just makes us a richer community.
Do you worry about Mayor Laura Hoydick of Stratford as the guest, do you worry about as cities and towns like yours grow and diversify and become more attractive because of the access to mass transit, things like Metro North, you worried about the cost of what the free market might dictate as far as, you know, maybe some units, housing units being out of the grasp of some people?
I do worry about that, and it's a constant conversation we have with our economic and community development folks, because we need to remain affordable to be attractive. And there are some things that we can do as a municipality, especially when we are supporting housing projects, that include workforce housing, mm-hmm. include senior housing, include veteran housing. You know, we have an agreement with the state of Connecticut. They conveyed the El Grosso Regional Center when they closed it from DDS, from Disabled Services. Housing up there, it's behind the armory.
Yeah.
And when it was conveyed to us, it was with the understanding that it would be affordable and veterans housing. And those are the kind of things that we're going to do to make Stratford maintain its good quality of life. Actually, we are working to improve the quality of life.
Yeah, because a lot of times you see, hey, new development within walking distance of a train station, and sometime a bell goes off, that means a high rent. You know what I mean?
Right. So, and market is market.
Yeah.
Private is private.
Yeah.
But we're really looking at public-private partnerships. That's what we're looking at the Center School site, and same thing at the El Grosso site. And we also have a great housing authority here, and so I'm looking forward to them expanding their reach and broadening some of the things that they offer to folks, too.
What's the toughest part of the job that you have to face when you walk into the office every day?
The toughest part of the job is not being able to help someone when they really need it. And that weighs on me. I know it's life. I don't want to sound Pollyanna, but there are some severe situations where people really need things, and we try the best we can, but we can't do everything for everybody, and it's unfortunate.
I would imagine that one of the toughest things, though, must be maintaining your neutrality between Bunnell and Stratford High Schools. I would imagine you're plied with bribes on both sides to root for one or the other, right?
So in my household, my husband and two older daughters graduated from Bunnell, and I and my youngest daughter graduated from Stratford High School.
Wow, there you go.
Yeah. We're also Yankee and Red Sox fans.
Oh,
so
boy.
Yeah.
Well, I got to tell you, the dinner time conversations must be great, huh?
Oh,
I love that.
It's winning.
Mayor Laura Hoydick of Stratford. Mayor, thank you. We love having you on, and we'll talk to you in the future.
Thank you, Paul.
Thanks. Appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Wow, four people in the household, two Red Sox fans, two Yankee fans, two Bunnell grads, two Stratford High grads. Man, oh, man. Eesh. What happens on Thanksgiving Day with that one, huh? Connecticut City's not faring too well in a new survey from the website WalletHub.com. WalletHub saying that Hartford is the ninth worst run city in New Haven in the country. New Haven 17th, and Bridgeport comes in at number 47. Joining us right now, an analyst for WalletHub, Jill Gonzalez, joins us from D.C. Hi, Jill. Paul here in Bridgeport. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. How are you?
Good. Worst run. What is the, if you can kind of lay out the statistical basis or kind of the parameters you folks were looking at when you ranked these 150 cities?
Sure. So we essentially looked at the quality of city services. That's everything from education, police department, safety, economy. So all of these things. And then we compared that to the budget per capita. So essentially, how much bang are you getting for your buck? Mm. How well run is your city?
So essentially, this is, you try to be as objective as you can, strictly from a dollar and cents point of view.
Right. Dollar and cents. This was in no way a survey asking people, because I think everyone in every city would say, my city is the worst run.
Mm-hmm.
That's the feedback we've gotten. But this is all based on things like Census Bureau, Labor Statistics, Council for Community and Economic Research. So all existing data that we put together in one place, weight, and rank accordingly.
Mm-hmm. So, and again, as it's pointed out here, some of these cities, you point out Hartford for one here, although its overall ranking was pretty high on the poorly run list, they did do kind of well in certain areas like health, infrastructure, and pollution. So it's not a complete downer here.
Not a complete downer. The composite metric certainly is not the best here. Right now, Hartford is sandwiched in between Cleveland and Flint, mm-hmm. as far as the 150 cities go. But when you look at the actual breakdown of city services, Hartford certainly does have some brighter spots.
And Bridgeport as well. Now, you had Bridgeport, where we're doing our show from here. I think you had Bridgeport at number 47 here out of 150. So it's not like it's actually near the top of poorly run purely from a dollar and cents metric here.
Right. And Bridgeport actually did top 10 when it just comes to the health statistics,
mm-hmm.
top 40 when it comes to safety. So, again, bright spots. You just have to look.
Yeah. And now city services, I mean, obviously that is, when you talk about spending per capita, a lot of people might not understand per capita, the theory meaning that this is a way to kind of level the playing field and look at this, Jill, correct or not, on a coldly statistical basis, equalizing all factors.
Exactly. So we looked at cities of varying sizes here, but to level the playing field, as mm-hmm. you said, we use this per capita.
Are you worried that when you do surveys like this, that you're going to get flack from people? And do you hear, and I'm not just talking about Connecticut here, but Jill, do you ever get any blowback from the cities or towns that may not do so well? Does anybody call you or leave nasty emails saying, come on, you're killing me here?
It's funny. So from the cities themselves, from, you know, chambers of commerces, economic research departments, we actually get more asks for the actual research, which we're happy to give out. So, you know, what were our health scores? What were our safety scores? What did infrastructure and pollution look like? A lot of times they really want to see the areas of weakness and improve. We get more blowback from consumers or from residents where their city is ranked highly, and they say, you've never been here. We have more potholes than the moon, you know. So it's funny. We get more blowback for giving a place a good ranking
than
a poor ranking.
Really? Because I figured, you know, what are you doing? You're killing my property value here. This is ridiculous. Somebody was going to buy my house. Then they went to Wallet Hub to do some research. But that's funny that people think you're too nice. That's just great.
Exactly. I mean, I think people want to see improvement in their town no matter what. So the need for that, I think, is certainly there. People want to be heard. So when they see themselves getting a pat on the back and they don't think it's deserved, that's actually when we get the most blowback.
And the previous point you made is interesting, that, you know, a lot of these cities and towns, like the major ones here in Connecticut, you know, they are squeezed for dollars where they might not have the resources to do surveys like this. So I can see where they would ask for those. For those complete lists, how tedious is this to do? Or are you just like shoving numbers in an algorithm here and trying to be as neutral as possible?
No, it certainly does take some work. So first of all, we talk to experts in the field, academic experts, about which metrics we should even include, which should have more of a weight than others. So first we have to work that all out. And then once we get all of the data, we have to, again, weight it and rank it accordingly. So it certainly takes about 4 to 6 weeks per one of these studies that we do.
Well, what do you think in general this shows? If I asked you, Jill Gonzalez at WalletHub.com, for a couple of bullet points in general, stepping back and looking at this in a macro setting, what are some of the things that kind of you had maybe an aha moment or two about how the cities are faring generally around the U.S., not just here in Connecticut?
Well, I think when it just comes to why some cities are better run than others, obviously the bigger a city gets, the more complex it is to manage. And the bigger city that it gets, a lot of times there's a lot more political competition. So what the residents want and what the residents need, a lot of the time it's put on a back burner.
Interesting.
To further a mayoral career, et cetera. So that's number one. And number two is just how government decisions are made. You know, are city council members making decisions about what happens in their neighborhood? Or, you know, that's kind of from the bottom up. Or is it the other way around? Is it more top down? Usually, cities run on that bottom up perspective are going to be more effectively run, because it's really, you know, hands on. What do the people need? Where are the problems the worst, et cetera?
That's interesting. So a bottom up perspective. Interesting, but not surprising. You know, the more hands-on, bottom-up is going to be, is that what you're saying? There's more integrated efficiency than if it's a traditional pyramid top-down setup.
Yeah, and I think especially in smaller places, like most of these Connecticut cities that we're talking about, I think that's where you see it most effective. In bigger cities, it's hard not to have a strong mayor versus a strong city council, and that, again, can get a lot done, but it's more so on what the mayor's vision is versus the people's.
Interesting. Jill Gonzalez, statistical consultant analyst for WalletHub.com. Jill, thanks. We appreciate the time today. Thank you.
Anytime. Have a good one.
Thanks. There you go. So some good numbers and some bad numbers. Hartford, Bridgeport, New Haven. You may want to listen up to this, because joining us right now to talk about the emerging or possibly emerging hemp industry in Connecticut is Michelle Siegel. She is the Connecticut Commissioner of the Department of Consumer Protection. We have some news on the hemp business. Commissioner Siegel, how are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay here in Bridgeport. So there was a piece of legislation recently signed, I understand, that now paves the way for hemp manufacturing. And I think people need to know, this doesn't mean these people are growing marijuana per se. The hemp plant is different.
That's right. And that's a really important thing for people to keep in mind. And so the big difference between hemp and marijuana, so it's a similar plant, but it has to be an incredibly low THC level for it to qualify as being hemp. And so that it's going to be tested when it's being grown and then again when it's being manufactured to be sure that the products out there aren't going to have high THC levels.
What now? How is the process moving along? Because I know now that there is an application process, much like the application process to, you know, be a medical marijuana manufacturer. Now we have farmers, Commissioner, correct, who are looking into this hemp thing.
That's right. And so the process to get into the hemp industry is very different and much simpler than it is to get into the medical marijuana business. And so the medical marijuana business is really being regulated as a medical industry. And so the people making products there are being regulated like drug manufacturers. Mm-hmm. With regard to hemp, it's not being treated as a controlled substance or a drug. And so the process there is much different. So there's sort of two important pieces to it. One is actually growing the plants. And so the hemp is a plant and it's an agricultural product. And so if you are a farmer, you want to set aside a few acres, try to get into the hemp business, see how that's going to work out for you. You would get a license from the Department of Agriculture. They have a good process there. You would go through that and you would have your license so that you could start growing these hemp plants. If then what you want to do is take your hemp plant and now make some products out of it, there's a variety of things you could do. You can obviously make cloths or things or non sort of consumable products like that. And that, again, is through the Department of Agriculture, and you can make those products. If what you want to do is take your plant, maybe extract something from it and make a food product, for example, or a lotion, then you would need a manufacturing license from the Department of Consumer Protection. And so we have the license online for that as well. But unlike the medical marijuana program, this is not a limited program. This is not going to be regulated at all like a drug manufacturing. We want to make, if this product's going to people's foods, mm-hmm. or if it's going to go in a lotion that you're going to, you know, rub on yourself, we want to make sure it's safe and that it doesn't have contaminants. So we're going to be testing for things like heavy metals, pesticides, the type of things you just ordinarily would not want in your food.
Commissioner, so is the licensing because the hemp plant would contain, even though it's marketed as hemp and not marijuana, is that because it would contain a small amount of THC or an intoxicant? Is that why there's going to be a licensing procedure here?
Well, the licensing, it's really required, so what allows for the hemp program to exist in Connecticut was some changes in federal law that has allowed states to create hemp programs. And to do that, it needs to be licensed and regulated, at least the plant growing part, by the Department of Agriculture. And so that's just a requirement of being in compliance with the federal program to sort of have hemp as an industry in the state of Connecticut.
Is there going to be a minimum size of a plot here? I guess my question would be, let's say somebody has just a house or a nice piece of property and they've got a quarter acre, a half acre, an acre, and they say, you know what, next to my tomatoes and green peppers and my watermelons, maybe I want to grow some hemp. Is there a limit to the size or of the type of person that can do this or not?
There's not a limit on size or anything. You know, the Department of Agriculture is going to have more details. But basically, the way the law is set up, you would get licensed to have a plot, and that can be a sort of contiguous area. It can be in a field. It can be in a greenhouse. It could be in an indoor growing structure, but where you're going to have the same strains of hemp all together. So however that's designed, and people can kind of look at the Department of Agriculture if they're looking to be in the farming end of this, and there's mm-hmm. going to be some good guidance. But there's really no limit. As I understand it, they're getting some people who are really not looking to do huge amounts of growing this season. They may be setting aside an acre or two, looking to sort of see how does this plant grow in Connecticut, what can I learn from it, what's the market like. So I think people are really starting to dip their toes in the water here and experiment a little, see by just setting aside a little bit of land. So
yeah.
It doesn't have to be a certain size.
Yeah, the reason I ask that is I don't want anybody listening here who might be interested in, you know, and say, well, no, this is just for commercial, commercial farmers here. I don't have 7, 8, 9 acres here. So this is not just aimed at them, is what you're saying.
I don't think there'd be anything prohibiting somebody who has a smaller plot of land from getting into it. And I would definitely encourage people, if this is something you want to do and you want to get into the piece of growing it, go to the Department of Agriculture's website, talk to them and see what you can do. They have a lot of information there.
You know, and I'm sure you've been knee-deep in this and have, you know, read about this, the economic potential of hemp. We were talking about it earlier on the show today. Hemp clothing is big still in some parts of the country and growing, and hemp seed as far as actually something you could eat. I've seen that in GNC and other stores. And, you know, done right, I guess this could be for some people, actually, Commissioner, kind of a real economic gold mine here.
Yeah, it certainly has a lot of economic potential, and I think you're seeing a lot of people interested in it for that reason. And that's what made it great, really, with our legislature, our governor, everybody really worked together. We work closely with the Department of Agriculture to do what we need to do so that this industry could launch in Connecticut and it could be available for people to start getting plants in the ground, start sort of seeing how the market's going to react.
I was in a GNC probably about 6 months ago. And up near the counter, there were these kind of little plastic containers like you get salad dressing in if you're buying a salad like in a convenience store. And they were full of hemp seed, like maybe half full of hemp seed. And they kind of were the size of poppy seeds, maybe a little more. Well, each one of those was marked at $19, right? And And I said to myself, you know, maybe if I can convince my condo association, this might lower our monthly fees. You never know, right?
Yeah, we'll see. Now that so many more people are growing it, we'll see what prices continue to look like. But it's certainly an industry where people seem to think there's money to be made.
On the hemp question, I see that there was some testimony in some of the public hearings that was interesting. They see, at least some of these people, see hemp as a way to help some of the struggling dairy farms here in the state, and also trying to get young people who are intrigued with the whole marijuana and hemp thing, get them interested in farming, because I guess there's a worry that a lot of young folks are not going to be able to take up Connecticut's rich history of farming, which we still have.
That could very well be. I think there's a lot of people who see, as other farming industries are becoming less profitable and are starting to fade away, that this is really an exciting new industry that can be available so people can maybe keep their farms going and repurpose that land for something else that may be more profitable than what they're currently doing.
Yeah, Commissioner, finally on other fronts, anything in your department that's percolating right now, any news, any consumer alerts that people should be wary of that have popped up in the last couple of weeks, maybe as we head into the middle of summer and then on the downside of the fall?
Not a whole lot new. It's Military Consumer Protection Month, and so we're out there with the Department of Veteran Affairs and the Attorney General's Office to really remind people, particularly who are in the military or maybe are donating to charities to support the military, to always be cautious who you give your money to. A lot of great charities out there. It's definitely an area you want to give money to, but you want to make sure your money is going for what you intend. So that's a big thing we're talking about this month. And so certainly I'm happy to let your listeners know. And, you know, anytime you want to give to charity, be sure to do a little research first.
Yeah, the scammers are always out there. And again, you know, they put an American flag on a webpage and they put a veteran out there and a picture of a down and out veteran. It's, you know, the scammers are out there and they'll try to get you each way. I don't know about you, Commissioner, but I always tell people, you know, one good source is either your website or charitynavigator.com. I always find is a good source for that sort of stuff.
Yeah, that's great advice. And just look that stuff up. Find the charity you're interested in. Don't definitely give to the first place that maybe shows up in a Facebook feed or somewhere else because you don't know. Do a little research. And then give directly to the charity once you decide it's the right one. And then you know where your money's going.
Michelle Siegel, the Commissioner of the Connecticut Department of Consumer Protection. Commissioner, thanks. We'll talk down the line.
All right, thank you.
Thanks, appreciate it. All right, get in on that hemp. See, Aaron, if this radio thing doesn't work out for you, you can do it. Now, I have some figures in front of me. Well, Aaron said, is there good money? Get this. Research shows, right, and I actually have a couple of radio friends of mine that have been researching this. That's all I'll say. Research shows that an acre of hemp, now, you know what, it's an acre is not a huge parcel. It's big enough. Acre is a pretty good size of land, but think about it. If people out in the sticks here in Connecticut, if they own, two, three, 4 acres, get this, kids. Especially if you own a plot of land. Research shows that an acre of hemp could generate the following yields. 500 pounds to 1,500 pounds of dried hemp flowers. Okay, before you, I guess, mash them up and make them into clothing or however that works. I have no idea the actual process. So if you can generate 500 pounds to 1,500 pounds of dried flowers from an acre, you can get between $30 and $100 a pound from 1 acre yield. And I actually heard these numbers from a couple of friends of mine who are researching it. They're thinking of going in with each other as Aaron's eyes just light up when I tell them this. Your dad's retired. Get a little capital from him. Say, Dad, I got an idea. Estimated revenues then, I guess, on a yearly basis. Do you grow this? I guess once a year. It's an annual, right? You grow it once a year. Estimated annual revenues for hemp. Listen up, kids. If you've got an acre and you do it well. Now, remember, there's costs involved here, too. You have to plant it. You have to irrigate it. An acre of land is a big piece of land. However, estimated annual revenues between $37,500 and $150,000 an acre. $37,500 to $150,000 an acre. How about that, huh? Let me see. Who said this? Said this guy. What's this guy's name here? He said one of these state agriculture folks saying hemp could be a lifeline for the agricultural economy, providing much-needed cash crop to a market that is strapped for cash crops. All right. So how about that? $37,500 to $150,000 an acre. Wow. We should do that here at the company, right? Out in the back here? Imagine that if we had to do the communal thing, all peace and love, right? Have the WICC hemp farm. It'd be great. You, me, Aaron, Tony, Melissa, get every Mancini, have everybody in here just tilling the fields. Then at the end of the year, we split up $150K. How great would that be? See, that's America for you right there. 600.com. Walt Pacelli is my name. Thank you so much for dropping by. Telephone number is always 203-333-9422. 203-333-WICC. Want to thank our previous guests. And if you're just joining us, didn't hear any of these interviews, you can check them out on our podcast. Go to WICC600.com and find the tab for our podcast. Pull that down and listen to all the great podcasts here at WICC from Tony and Melissa in the morning and here with us on Connecticut Today. Earlier today, we talked to Stratford Mayor Laura Hoidick to kick off the show. Also spoke with the state's Consumer Protection Commissioner, Michelle Siegel, about the growing hemp industry. And we also spent a few minutes with an analyst from WalletHub.com to talk about their recent ratings regarding how well and how efficiently Bridgeport, Hartford, and New Haven are run. So if you missed it or you want to hear it again or send it to somebody, say, hey, listen to this, go to WICC600.com or go to wherever you get your podcasts and put in the search term WICC600. All right. 203-333-9422. One of the big topics so everybody's calling in on today is immigration. Couple of things you heard earlier or may have just heard there in the 5 o'clock hour that the president is saying, all right, we can forget the immigration question on the census. He's not going to do that about whether or not someone is an actual citizen of the U.S. It's been asked before on and off. In fact, I've got a list here. It was asked back in the 1800s. We haven't done it. We did it up until about 1950. Then there was a gap. And then, of course, it came back in 2000 and a few years ago. So now the idea is, do you put that back in again? The president's detractor is saying, well, you only want to essentially screw big Democrat-controlled cities. His supporters saying, hey, listen, we need to get a better look at exactly, you know, how many illegals are in this country. But again, don't mistake this from what is going to happen this weekend. That's been the big national story all day. But you folks have had a lot of good opinions on it at 203-333-9422. There are going to be raids this weekend by ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, in 10 major cities, targeting about 2,000 individuals or family members. I'm not sure where they're getting the actual numbers from, but these are people that have in some way, shape, or form overstayed a court order. But again, and the only reason I'm talking about this today, because I want to make sure you understand what's going on here as far as, you know, the information you're going to get or not get or whatever. These are about 2,000 people who have been ordered out of the country because I guess their cases have been adjudicated already by immigration courts. But again, you see what's happening here. I just pulled up a random story here, just a random story. This one, I did a Google search. I came up with one from USA Today. Immigration advocates brace for ICE roundups across the country. The goal, they say, is to terrorize. That's what they say. Folks, I'm telling you, when you see this weekend, it is going to be wall-to-wall coverage. They're going to show little kids crying. They're going to depict ICE agents, hardworking men and women who are trying to secure the borders as Gestapo, Nazi. I told you, I think it was a couple of weeks ago. I have a good friend in this business who every time ICE comes up, it's like he starts to twitch. He thinks they should be disbanded. He calls them Trump's brown shirts, Nazis. But this illustrates a bigger point. And follow along with me here if you can. And anytime you want to chime in, 203-333-9422. I don't care whether it's immigration or whether it's labor law or whether it's election law or whether it's tax law. I have always looked at things this way. And maybe I'm just that kind of guy. Maybe I'm just an angry white suburban guy who tends to look at things in the simplest way possible. I've looked at these things for several years and asked myself, is this legal or is it illegal? To me, it's pretty simple. Well, what this person did with his taxes or what the president's doing with his taxes or Nancy Pelosi is doing with his taxes or what the mayor of Bridgeport or Hartford or New Haven or Waterbury, whatever, what are they doing with their taxes? Well, to me, is it, I don't care who they are, where they're from. It's either legal or it's illegal. And if you don't like the laws on something, you change the laws. Now, here's a good example. What's the name of this place? The American Immigration Council, whatever that means, said, quote, "No one arrested in the immigration raids should be deported without a fair day in court. We are recruiting and training immigration attorneys from around the country to ensure this happens." Another Unido U.S. tweeting a list of do's and don'ts for immigrants. Don't open doors. Don't say anything to ICE agents or sign anything, they said. Take pictures and get a lawyer. The tweet said, "As the threat of ICE raids brings fear to our communities, it is important that you know your rights." Okay, that's fine, whatever. But they also point out in the story, the sweep here, this is according actually to a New York Times story, the sweep this weekend would target more than 2,000 immigrants facing deportation orders who remain in the country illegally. Sources telling the Times ICE planned to keep family members together at family detention centers whenever possible. So here is my question, and maybe you can help me out on this. I don't get it. Honestly, I'm at my wit's end here. Maybe you could help me out at 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. How have we arrived to the point in this country where we are giving advice to people who have been told, apparently by the federal government, apparently, if I'm reading this right, maybe I'm not, I don't think I'm that stupid. I can be dumb. I don't think I'm that stupid. How are we massing all these resources to keep people in the country? Why are we doing this if these cases apparently have already been adjudicated in a court of law? Are we now at a point where we let our feelings run the country? Why are we allowed? Why is this happening? I mean, look, maybe I'm just a cold jerk. Maybe I am. But if I see a little kid crying this weekend and a family, if they have a court-ordered deportation, why? Then what do we do with the law? That's my bigger question. What do we do with the law? What good is the law in this country? What good is the law? You tell me. What are we supposed to do? What's the answer? Do we just throw our arms up and say, nah, well, whatever, you can stay? Is that fair? What about the people that have spent thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars to come here the right way? If you don't like what ICE is going to do, you give me your idea. I'd love to hear. My other question, though, here is on immigration. It's coming to a bit of a head this weekend. You're going to see video of all these ICE raids. You're going to see local police not cooperating. You're going to see, probably he's going to get violent, I would think, in one part or another. You may get some of these Antifa dirtbags out there. You're going to get people who are going to try and interfere with ICE people. But here's my question. If you do not want to enforce the law against people who apparently have been told, and have been told some time ago, I read where some of these cases go back two and a half years, that they must leave the country, then what good is the law if you don't enforce it, right? I'm not just talking about immigration, taxes, business law, any type of law or regulation we have. Honest question. I'm not putting that out there for effect here. What good is the law if we don't follow it? Let's go to my hometown of New Haven, the Great Elm City. Jane is with us. Jane, hi. You're on WICC.
Hey, good afternoon, Paul.
Hi, Jane.
I couldn't agree with you more. It ceases to amaze me that we have people who are in this country who want to live the American dream. I get that. But the American dream starts with following rules. If there's a legal process for them to become citizens, do it, and it's not a problem. We welcome them with open arms. We have for centuries. Why can't they follow the legal process?
You know, on every year, Jane, I looked this up once, and I've seen it in several spots. Every year, we end up through work green cards, work visas, student visas, naturalization. We admit about a million people a year to this country, basically the size of the Boston Metro. We admit to this country. So all this psychobabble notion, word verbiage we hear, chafe, flack, whatever it is, of us, you know, hating foreigners and hating brown people. What are those people talking about? It makes no sense.
We have a system. And the people that follow the system, I used to work in an institution that was based, was faith-based,
mm-hmm.
and we had a nun who somebody misfiled her paperwork, and she was packing her belongings because she knew they said her paperwork wasn't filed correctly,
wow.
and she was going to have to leave. She didn't want to break the rules. Why aren't more people, and why does this country want people in this country who are willing to knowingly break the rules to be here?
I have never
understood it.
Jane, I have never understood I understand there are very well-meaning, well-intentioned, kind, benevolent, warm people who want to help people that are less fortunate. It's the American way. We give billions and billions of dollars in charity and in kind time. But sometimes I want to ask these people, do you understand that everything you do or don't do, everything we do, Jane, or don't do, sends a message to someone? And when you coddle people into saying, well, you know what, we know you crossed our border illegally, but you can stay. Well, again, Jane, like I said, what good is the law?
Agreed. And if the individual who is willing to donate to people who are here illegally could donate to people who are here legally, our veterans, look at what's happened to our veterans' health system. These people have sacrificed their bodies, their families, mm-hmm. their minds, and we can't give them the best health care. They're looking for resources, but yet you come here illegally and you can walk into any hospital and get the best of care and go, oh, well, that's what I'm here for.
Yeah.
Is that American dream?
Yeah.
I don't understand it.
And yet I have talked, Jane, to people even up to, you know, yesterday, a couple of days ago, people who have come here legally, who became over 10, 20 or 30 years, a good friend of mine in the broadcast business, has been a dual citizen, former NHL hockey player, played his career, had a good career in the NHL, retired in Pennsylvania. And you know what? He was thinking of going back to Canada. He's been a dual citizen, but he said, you know what? No, I love this country. And he finally went through the paperwork and everything. He's lived here, obviously, legally with his wife after his career, and he became a U.S. citizen. And he put in the time, the effort, the money. He said it wasn't cheap, but he said that's what he felt he owed this country, you know?
How have we defined by willingly and knowingly acknowledging people who are here illegally? How would we redefine the American dream?
Well, I think, and Jane, I've got to run. Thank you so much for calling. I do appreciate it.
You're welcome.
To hear from you again. Thank you, Jane. I think by nature, by who we are as Americans, by who we are as individuals, by who we are as families, we sometimes allow our emotions to get the best of us. It's almost like we forgot the rules that were imparted to us, pardon me, by our moms and dads, our teachers, our coaches, our camp leaders, our scout leaders, whatever, our bosses, that, you know, there are rules. And let me tell you something before we go to news here. I tell you something. If you're a left of center voter, if you despise President Trump, if, like friends of mine, you want to see him defeated, if you're a Democrat, I'm not necessarily if you're a Democrat, but if you want to see the president defeated, and you don't understand how empirically wrong a lot of people are in the opposition party on this issue, there's nothing I can do for you. I'm telling you, I could be wrong on this, but I'm telling you, the immigration issue, it's hitting a nerve with people. I've talked to numerous people who say to me, you know what they say? I'm paraphrasing. Not a big Trump fan, but he's right on immigration.